Welcome, everyone. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Happy Sunday. Good day. Top of the morning, whatever you say. At the beginning of your day, we are excited to have you here. Grateful for your presence because your presence adds value every week. Clearly, I'm not Kelly Joy Richardson. I'm Dr. Vicki Johnson, sitting in for Kelly today, who's on travel. But Dr. D and I, our executive director, Dr. D Sapp, and I are here today to hold space and have a very powerful, engaging dialogue and conversation. So we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome again to our weekly Sunrise Project call. We're happy that you're here and hope that you find a moment of solace and peace and clarity and some understanding. And I'm going to add relief a little bit as we share and learn from one another in a safe and sacred space filled with love, compassion, and a mutual desire to heal our children, our families, and ourselves. God grant us the serenity to accept the things that we cannot change, the courage to change the things that we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We are grateful to have our guests back with us again. He's been with us twice in the past, and we're so grateful for his willingness and availability to be with us again today. Our guest is Norm J. Jones, Dr. Norm J. Jones, PhD. He is an organizational development scholar, practitioner with a focus on equity-minded executive leadership and team development. With over 25 years' experience in higher education and organizational management, he has held senior leadership roles at large-scale organizations and some of the nation's premier colleges and universities. His past positions include special assistant to the superintendent of Harrisburg City Schools, associate vice president and dean of institutional diversity at Dickinson College, associate chief diversity officer at Harvard University, and Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer at Amherst College. As a published author, Dr. Jones has contributed several articles and book chapters and is a sought-after speaker and lecturer. He frequently speaks on topics such as diversity as ecology, inclusive onboarding, building trust among mid-managers, and tomorrow's DEI. A graduate of Harvard's Institute for Educational Management and the Tavistock Institute on Human Relations. Y'all should look that up if you haven't before. He was also an Arthur Vining Davis Fellow at the Aspen Ideas Festival. He holds a BA in English from Morehouse College and both a Master of Public Administration and a PhD in Workforce Education and Development from Pennsylvania State University. He also holds offices in the Chi chapter of Omega Psi Phi fraternity and Beta Sigma Boule. In his personal time, Dr. Jones enjoys life with his beautiful wife, Paula, their blended family of three, and their two very spoiled French bulldogs, Bella and Jaden. So welcome back, Dr. Norm Jones, my brother. Thank you for being here with us again today to talk about belonging and to explore this issue surrounding our children with a village that is safe to the best of our ability. Because as we know, parenting is not for the faint. And we came up with a theme to frame our conversation today. Who's in the boat with you? Raising children. So they are never alone. So we're happy to have you. Norm, thank you for being here. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me. This is a real privilege to be back in this space.
And again, we want to welcome all of you here to this powerful, needed conversation. In light of what's happening in the world, I first do want to acknowledge that there are many parents who have experienced the loss of a child. And so I want to presence and open our conversation with that and hold space for those families, those moms and those dads who have lost children to a tragedy, to death due to illness. Whatever the case may be, there are many, many parents who have experienced the loss of a child, Norm. And I'm gonna call you Norm. Everyone, Norm is my brother. I'm his sister. So we're just gonna talk today and hopefully have a collective exhale and release. And one of the most recent headlines, Norm, that has shaken many parents to the core, of course, is this tragic death of Nolan Wells on Horn Island in Mississippi. And for many of us in this community, what it does is it triggers a visceral and terrifying reality, a concern, right, for our children's personal safety, mental health, and how we help them navigate such changing, often turbulent times. But before we can co-regulate emotionally with our children, we must process our own. As parents, our own secondary trauma and acute anxiety. So, when we talk about who's in the boat with you, raising children so they are never alone, how, as we, as parents, moms and dads, grandmothers, grandfathers, aunts and uncles, how can we center ourselves in that question? Who's in the boat with us, right? Who's gonna come back and make sure we're okay? And that's one of the things I love about the Sunrise Project. And this Sunday community call is, I feel like everyone here on this call, we're in this boat together. But what does that bring up for you as a Black man, as a Black father, as a Black scholar in predominantly white spaces a lot of times? So that's where we want to go. I just wanted to kind of frame where we are, where we're going, and what we want to talk about today. Also acknowledging, that a lot of us are holding our breath, right? How do you process? How do you grieve when you're still trying to figure out what happened? And no, it's not our child today, but I know for me, it triggered, oh my goodness. Every time I see them on television or another parent online saying, I have great compassion for his parents. But you know what? My child died the same way, and nobody talked about it. So it's so much. And so thank you for being here and helping us process, even if it's just a little bit, what is happening in the world. So who's in the boat with you? What does that bring up for you? And how do we create a sense of belonging and village for ourselves, our families, and our children? I
Thank
know that
you.
was like 20 questions, but
No,
you put
but
I
this
wanted to
is,
give
I
you a
mean,
space and give
we've
you some
got that many
options.
and more. Thank you, Dr. Vicky, for again for having me. And I do honestly count it a privilege to be in this space. Because part of the reason is because, when you referred to holding our breath, that's real. Like in the literal sense. And it's interesting. It's kind of ironic, I guess, in some ways. I am inherently a shallow breather. I learned that about myself in the past few years. And so breathing in a way that kind of maximizes the space inside me is not something that comes naturally. And it makes me think about how easy it is for the slightest thing to cause me to kind of like unconsciously hold my breath. And I think spaces like this allow us to breathe through things. And so, this question of who's in the boat with us, even, is partially about taking collective breaths together. And when I think about the last few years, I realize that part of the value in collectives and community spaces and even families is that we do have an opportunity to talk. And I've been talking with my wife and kids about Nolan Wells, but we've also talked about other tragedies. And it is surfacing information I didn't really have necessarily about how my kids think about friend groups and what happens when and if something goes a different way than you had planned. And so it's I've developed even in the last 48 hours kind of like a deeper appreciation for what happens when you take the time to talk to your kids about what if kinds of scenarios. And that can be a scary thing because I'm not interested in trying to trigger or traumatize my kids, obviously. But I do realize that I actually need to know what how they think and what goes on in their minds as it relates to their own safety and the way they think about the safety of others. And I know we're going to talk about our experiences as parents, but I just want to jump into the kid space for a minute because one thing I learned about my middle kid, and you know, this is DNA. It is what it is. He was like, "Dad, I'm going to tell you, if I was in a situation that seemed like it was becoming unsafe, I'm definitely going to be the guy that's naming that for myself and for my friends. But if it looks like things are going from bad to worse, and my friends aren't heeding my warnings, at some point I'm out." And you know, there's part of me that kind of wants to give a speech about like staying in the boat. But there's another part of me that's like, you know, grateful that my son has a level of judgment that allows him to gauge when something crosses over into a space where his own safety may be at risk, in which case he can't help anybody. And knowing that he has the ability, prayerfully, to know when he's crossed over to the other side of that line so that he can attend to his own safety is also something for which I have gratitude. So these are the kinds of things that I recognize now as conversations that I need to be having with my kids more often, not necessarily in reaction to a thing that has already happened, but just learning more about how they think about safety and friend groups and being in community and judgment and what happens if. I think there's value in those kinds of conversations, and I'm actually looking forward to having more of those conversations with my kids. I've got a big gap. I have a 28-year-old and a 15-year-old and a soon to be 13-year-old. And the 13-year-old is the only girl. And I think she'll probably have things to say even about being the only girl when it comes to groups and safety and all of that. So I'm just reminded of the importance of talking with our kids and talking with one another and breathing together, even as we're trying to process tragedies like this last one.
I love that. Thank you so much. You know, for me, this brings up what you said and even just what's happening, which I think is why I'm so drawn to the conversations, I'll say, around this case and Nolan Wells is because I personally know, as many of our children do, what it's like to be the only or one of a few in predominantly white spaces. You know, I grew up when I was in, middle school, that was a scenario for me. And this really, for me, brought up, yeah, that was different. It was unique. And that's not to say that there are not unhealthy Black friend groups, because we know that there are. But in this case, and specifically, it raises uncomfortable conversations that need to be had. And so there's something that I wanted to just share to continue the conversation that I saw online that I thought was really powerful and food for thought. It says, "It wouldn't surprise me if this child was just trying to navigate two different worlds, only to run into historical intolerance of a community resisting integration. I know exactly what that feels like. People love to claim they are not discriminatory until they are actually confronted with someone different. Then the mask slips. It's understandable to distance yourself from someone dangerous or criminal, but rejecting regular people simply because of their skin color, religion, or perspective is pure hypocrisy. So many people talk a good game about your space, Dr. Norm, diversity, equity, and inclusion, because, which has also been under attack, by the way. We're mindful of that, because they've been taught to say the right things, but their actions reveal the truth. It's incredibly demoralizing to realize that people are just pretending to accept you. And that's the quagmire for our children. And it's a quagmire for us as parents in the workplace, in our communities where some of us live, in athletic communities and environments where we put our children. We are given to basketball, football, track, right? But what about when we're raising swimmers, Dr. D and Kelly? We're raising lacrosse players. We are raising soccer players. Raising black hockey players, right? I know parents in this situation. So it's incredibly demoralizing to realize that people are just pretending to accept you. And ultimately, it's a harsh but necessary lesson. Just because someone says they welcome you doesn't mean they actually do. And I just want to put that in our face to process what we are feeling and to invite us as parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, godparents, to give ourselves permission to start, permission and courage to start having these uncomfortable conversations, right, with ourselves and with our children. So I thought that was really a powerful perspective and nudge, if you will, to revisit some of these conversations and add to that the added pressure of the digital landscape. We didn't have that growing up. We didn't have TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. Those were not factors. Now they are. Snapchat, phones. We didn't have that. Add that to this generation and what they have to deal with. And for me, my heart goes to the parents not being able to grieve and simultaneously trying to figure out what happened, doing their own investigation. So thank God for the people that have stepped up to surround them. And again, my heart also goes out and I send prayers and love to those families and parents who didn't get this publicity, who didn't get this exposure. And I just want to acknowledge their pain and their grief, because when one of us hurts, we all hurt. So this is a collective experience, regardless of your zip code. This is a collective experience, because by all presentations, this was a good kid. And all of our children, right? We love them regardless. This young man was doing everything right. Being a bridge, he had black friend circles, white friend circles. So this conversation today, really, family, to those listening, it's for us to really sit in this discomfort and let's explore. So Norm, what has it been like for you navigating your spaces in your high performing environments and social circles? What has that been like for you as a black educated scholar, leader? What has it been like for you to navigate your spaces?
Well, I mean, a journey, no question. And, moments like this do cause me to go back in my mind and replay particular conversations where race and location, meaning geography, and culture came up in the conversation. And I'm kind of an interesting case, maybe in some ways, because I was a sandwich kid. I was raised in a home with my maternal grandparents. Both of whom were from the South. My maternal grandmother was from Kentucky. My maternal grandfather was from Biloxi, Mississippi. And my mother was born in Gadsden, Alabama. And we moved to Louisville, Kentucky, into the home with my grandparents after my parents got divorced at the age of 3. And I remember conversations that teetered on not arguments necessarily, but kind of debates, philosophical debates between my mother and her parents, because my grandparents were of a generation, I think, that definitely subscribe to the notion that the closer you got to whiteness, the more of an indication you had that you were ascending, succeeding, overcoming, maybe even. And that makes complete sense, right, of that generation. And my mother, who again was raised in Gaston, Alabama, moved to Louisville, Kentucky. I believe the schools integrated in Louisville, Kentucky during her senior year of high school. And I remember her telling me that out of her entire senior class at Central High School in Louisville, Kentucky, one person out of that senior class left and went to another school as a result of her family having relocated and moving into a different neighborhood. And so my mom was aware of the ways in which moving closer to privileged spaces afforded certain opportunities, and was simultaneously kind of cautious, I think, in the way that she messaged to me as a parent, because I think she saw in very stark terms what being the only, fill in the blank, usually black person in otherwise white space, could mean for my own socialization. And my mother was a sociologist and a social worker, so she also saw the other side of events gone wrong, I think, many of which had to do with, race and gender and class and the complications of all those things. So I did grow up in all white private schools from pre-K all the way through high school. And looking back on it, I can say that there was a divide, I would say, between classmates, associates, acquaintances who I knew to hold particular ideologies, and I would not have considered them friends, and those that I did consider close friends. But the nuance that I don't think I necessarily would have recalled until just now is that my determination that those people were friends, many of those folks were friends, grew out of situations where they needed to demonstrate that I was more than a stereotype to them. And I'm not sure that I necessarily would have known that, 10 or 12 years ago. If we were going to concerts, if we were hanging out, if you loaned me some money and I loaned you some money, like these were my metrics. But I remember one friend saying to his father, when the father learned that I had chosen to go to Morehouse College, and asked me if I applied to other kinds of schools, the friend was the one that said what an HBCU is, because he didn't know, and kind of interrupted this idea that I'd settled. I didn't explain that. My friend was talking about the value of HBCUs, essentially. Now, I'm not saying that that meant that he was, necessarily down for the cause and all of that, but it was a demonstration of someone expressing
Being in the boat with
friendship,
you.
being in the boat, right? Someone expressing friendship in a way that has to do with understanding who you are beyond these trite identities or these surface identities or the things that we always look to, like race or what we think about somebody based on class and all of that. So it's not so much if you leave with five, you come back with five, if you don't know who the five are, because maybe I want you to come back with four, actually. And so I've become more and more curious about not only who my kids' friends are, but we've had conversations about what makes them friends. How do you choose
Yes.
friends? And what
Yes.
I have learned about many of my kids' friends has come through the way they have navigated adverse situations. I actually have been privileged to watch them work through a conflict I have watched some of my kids' friends call them out on their foolishness and vice versa. And so that's the kind of friend that I want in the boat with my kid.
Dr.
I would
D
even go as
put
far as to say irrespective of race.
yeah, Dr. D put in a comment, you know, she just read the other day that proximity to whiteness does not guarantee protection. Proximity is not inclusive of protection always. And that assumption, I pray is shattered because we make a lot of assumptions. And so the opportunity to let go of those assumptions and ask the hard questions and demonstrate that in our own lives, and then as an example to our children, to teach them how to do the same thing. Because I had to acknowledge that I just thought it came organically when it doesn't. A lot of things I was not taught, you know, and my parents did the best that they could, and we do the best that we can. So it's communities like this and conversations like this in safe spaces where we're learning tools that we did not have before. I was that mom. I went to the bus stop every new school year until my daughter graduated from high school. I sure did. Like, I wanted you all to see me, you know, the bus driver. I've gone to the school. I've done that. And we have to talk about who is that friend? Where are you going? Where is that place? When are you coming back? Who's driving? Who's the adult in cases like that? And I am not intimating at all that Nolan's parents did not do those things, because there's that conversation online as well about him not being protected, which I think is unfair. You can't make assumptions unless you're sitting in someone's seat, walking, or have walked in their shoes. But I think for us, talking about who's in the boat with us and our children is very relevant. And this is an opportunity even for us to revisit conversations with our adult children, because he was a young adult. He was 18 years old. He was 18 years old. So it is important. I want to ask another question because I know you and I can talk for hours as we have. You speak often about aligning your purpose and living aligned with purpose and spiritual grounding, right? So how can we as parents channel this deep collective worry, because it's there, anxiety, and some trepidation? How can we channel this into constructive family or community wellness instead of it causing us to withdraw? What are some of the opportunities of this moment? What are some of the opportunities of wellness in this moment from your perspective as a scholar, educator, you know, being in community with your fraternity and Omega Psi Phi fraternity? You know, what are some opportunities for us as Black and Brown people to channel this moment into something that makes us better, right? Like, we're having to squeeze through this place of pain right now collectively, but how can we channel this into collective wellness and family? If you have any questions or you want to make any comments, we're going to open up in just a few moments. So you can type it in the chat, you can come off mute, you can raise your hand, so that you can get involved in this conversation as well. We're just really laying some groundwork so that we can have some healthy conversation this morning, as we always do.
So this is what I think here, Vicky. I think, especially as Black folks, we have to really, like, for real, get okay with first going inside. That's what I wrote down a little earlier this morning. Going inside to tap into truth. The truth may be, I'm scared right now. The truth may be, I'm really uncomfortable about the fact that I don't have more answers. The truth may be, yeah, it's messed up that I don't know what's around the corner, and yet I don't have the luxury of being still. I gotta keep walking toward that corner. And the truth is also that I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. The truth is also none of us can actually live in a bubble or just stop living. And so there's an element of risk and just getting up every morning and taking some steps outside your front door. All those things are true. But what is it that ultimately brings us some peace? What allows us to exhale, even if only for a fleeting moment? And those answers, those solutions, those strategies, I believe that's on the inside of us. And I want to be the kind of citizen, frat brother, church member, parent for sure, spouse, who taps into resources that are inside myself before I look to an external entity to tell me how I should feel or how I should cope or how I should frame a situation, because there's way too much of that. And if that is your go-to, you're going to be immediately overwhelmed. So what that then brings up for me is, to what extent are we taking the time to normalize and even promote for our younger kids, the next generation, that the inside of you is one of your best resources? I'd be lying if I said that in that every time my kids bring me something, I'm like, well, did you pray about it? But that would be a good thing to say, right? Or whatever your spiritual practice is, there's got to be something that you see as larger than you, larger than a problem, larger than a particular community that holds, if not some answers, some solace, some peace, some relief. And so when we deploy that practice individually and then come into a community space with that mentality, then that starts to create a groundswell of wellness, I think. And so even, if I use Omega as an example, and a credo, a motto that friendship is essential to the soul, I 100% believe that. And I also know that there are some fraternity brothers that I can truly call a friend based on my experience of them and what I know about myself. And there are other fraternity brothers who are fraternity brothers, right? But friendship is essential to the soul. But what that means for me is mine to determine.
Yes.
And so I think that's almost like a skill that we need to both model and try to pass on to our kids so that they are. So they can exercise some agency in relying on themselves, their intuition, their gut, their spiritual practice as part of how they navigate the world.
Love that. Let's talk about peer pressure and the pressure of the pressure. Pressure to perform, pressure to say I can swim when I can't. That's my experience, literally, at a summer camp. I'm one of two black girls at a majority white summer camp. When it was just a weekend camp, and we're in a lake, and everybody's like, let's swim to the other side. True story. I walk a little bit. Oh, they're swimming. My other friend, the other black girl, was like, I'm not going in that water. Me? Oh, I'm going to follow them. I was good as long as I could touch the bottom. And I probably almost drowned that day. I did almost drown. A lifeguard had to come and get me following the crowd because I wanted to belong. I wanted to fit in, as many of us have done. The older you get, those layers of wanting and needing that validation kind of peel away. I'm not that way anymore. But how do we deal? How have you dealt? Let me ask you that. How have you dealt with peer pressure in some very high visibility environments that you've been in? As a leader, as a scholar, have you dealt with that? And how have you helped your, I'm going to talk about your young adult son a little bit. How is he doing with all of this in his late 20s, approaching his 30s? How is your son dealing with that?
So in terms of my own experiences with peer pressure and following, one of the things that has helped me heal, and also I pray helped my children, is that I talk about it. I tell the summer camp story. One of the stories I tell is way, way, way up in adulthood, where when I would go to certain events, social events, especially in a work context, I would not eat chicken, fried chicken, nor would I eat watermelon or do anything else that fit the stereotype, because I didn't want to be complicit in validating those stereotypes. Here's the reality. I love fried chicken and I love watermelon. And so I had this experience. I think maybe it was at a Harvard reception of all places, but I could be wrong, but I think that's where it was, where I just had this kind of light bulb moment where I started thinking about my own credentials and worthiness and right to be in the space. And the thought that I had was, like, if this really smart dude who is the associate chief diversity officer can't eat a piece of watermelon without someone thinking XYZ, then whether I eat the watermelon or not, they're going to have the thoughts they have. So why rob myself of the opportunity to do something I want to do because I have an imagination about what others are thinking? So I've tried to share part of my journey in the context of the inner voice that tells me to follow, that succumbs to the peer pressure, and to try to talk about what allowed me to move beyond that. And sometimes it was an epiphany, other times it was feedback. I had one board member tell me one time many years ago, "You give away your power." Now that stung, but I was like, "Say more." And she went on to talk about the fact that when I would introduce myself, there was kind of an apologetic tone in there because there was some imposter syndrome stuff going on. So we need folks around us too that can help us see ourselves. And I think with my oldest son, who's now 28 and has three kids of his own, fatherhood has gone a long way in helping him look in a mirror that he always knew was there, but didn't necessarily look into. And that's what kids will do. That's what marriage will do as well. These reflections of you, whether it's a partner or your kids or even others who are close to you that help you see what you've not dealt with sufficiently, it will, one way or the other, you're going to have to deal with you. And I think that's what I would say about my oldest, is that becoming a father of three black boys has helped him confront parts of himself that he would rather not engage, talk about, process. And so, where I didn't get with him as a dad, there's some openings there because now he's a dad. And so, sometimes this stuff is also generational. And the beauty of it is you have an opportunity many times to go back and deal with some stuff. We can't change events, but we can transform the way we process those events, because the trauma of many of those events live on a physiological level. And so there's always an opportunity for healing. Even when folks are no longer with us, there's an opportunity for healing. So I don't want to discredit or skip over the beauty of intergenerational processing and conversations and reflection and journaling, again, going inside, even to go backwards so that you can continue to go forward. So it's just, there's no end to this. It just regenerates. And when you see it, then you can confront it.
Yeah, I think this is a huge opportunity for all of us to have impact, plant seeds, cultivate seeds that have already been planted, water some of what's already been planted, and then to create new gardens, right, in our community. When you talk about go inside, I know you mean for us to go inside ourselves. Personally, I think it's also an invitation for us to go deeper into our own community,
For
right, and
sure.
create spaces that are empowering, that do reflect you are great, right? I had adults around me reflecting to me my greatness, not necessarily what they wanted me to be based on their experiences, but it is the manifestation truly of, train children in the way they should go. That really translates into what are their gifts? Now raise them in their gifts so that as they grow older, they will not depart from what they came here with, what they, the gifts and tools and skills they were created to manifest into the world. We had a comment in the chat, Norm, being accepted is deeply integrated into our fascia from generations and generations and generations ago. Hence the Crown Act, right? You can't wear your hair in braids to work. You can't wear your hair in an afro. You know, my daughter got reprimanded once because she has big curly hair when it's all out. And a black man in management, reprimanded her. And, we had to address that. Like, what do you mean? That's her hair. And basically, what he was saying is your hairstyle isn't white adjacent enough. You can't come in here with big hair, hence the Crown Act. I totally love and respect this space of authenticity for us all. Another comment, there's no end to this, it just regenerates. Raise them in their gifts. And so we have about 15 minutes left here on the call. I want to open the space. If you have a question, if you have a comment, please come off mute. We invite you to share. If you have a question for Norm or something you want to say, how are you feeling about this current situation? And every time another black boy or a black girl dies tragically under suspicious circumstances, my mind goes back, all of us, in this generation, a lot of us go back to Emmett Till. Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, George Floyd, like there is a list. And all of that comes up again. And so I just want to offer the opportunity. We're not psychotherapists on here today. Dr. Linda was last week. So you got to come back on the first Sunday for our open session, or talk with your therapist. But we just want to create space here today for you to share what's on your heart, ask a question. If you would like to do that, don't want to get like right to the end of the call and not have opened up space to do that. So, are there any questions? If you're on the phone, you can hit star six or you can unmute your microphone if you're on Zoom. And if not, I'm going to ask another question. It is a space to just kind of be contemplative. Rebuilding trust. How do we do that in times like this when trust has, when our trust has been abused, misused, gaslit? How do we rebuild trust when circumstances feel profoundly unjust or unsafe? Right? How do we help our children maintain a capacity for healthy trust in their peers? And in the wider community, and systems. How do we do that? How do we hold on to hope and trust during times like this?
So when I think about trust, I think we really have to kind of parse some things, because I'm not sure that rebuilding trust or even establishing trust is actually the order of the day across the board. For example, what came up in my mind when you were naming some of the sports that are that have historically and are presently more white in terms of representation. There are legacy cultures there. And so I think it would be naive for anyone to think that that culture doesn't show up in a space just because that sport is now better integrated or because a particular friend group seems to have accepted an individual into that friend group, that culture, that macro culture is still there. And so when I think about trust, I think about opportunities to remind and educate our kids about those cultures, which they may or may not experience, because I call them legacies. So, depending on the space, it may show up, it may not, but rest assured it's there. If you're at the polo match, I promise you, racism is also at the polo match. Whether you see it, feel it, or not. And so it seems to me that there is an opportunity to go a little further in reminding our kids of those cultures and what they bring with them and what they mean, in terms of our own awareness and how we understand our surroundings, while also giving them permission to be themselves and to let down their shoulders when they feel that that trust has been established between themselves and two or three friends or their friend group. Like, we need to be able to hold this duality. I remember when I worked at Dickinson College, driving home with an American studies professor who I'd learned went to the same high school I went to. He was also from Louisville, Kentucky. And so he was like, "Oh, well, we go home all the time. Let's like go together at some point." So we're in this car and we're going from Carlisle, Pennsylvania to Louisville, Kentucky, and we stopped in Wheeling, West Virginia for gas. I think I was the one that got out to pump the gas, but the eyes on that car, it may as well have been 1960, whatever. And we talked about it almost the whole way home because, like, history is also the present. And so I think we need to remind more than ever in this day and time our kids the ways in which history will always be with us. And that doesn't mean you can't and shouldn't exercise agency in establishing trust. But let's talk about the indicators of trust. How do you know when you have it? And if it's breached, how do you know if you should try to rebuild it? And I think that's true for people, places, and things. And so that's a life skill in my mind.
That's so good. That's so good. We have a hand raised. You can come off mute. I see your
Hi.
hand. Hi, how
Yeah,
are you?
can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for having this opportunity to talk about the latest of what just happened. Wells, and I was thinking about this as well, because last night our son, he is 25 years old, and he is a coach for lacrosse. He's actually a school teacher, but he's coaching lacrosse as well. And so they had a trip last night, a game for a tournament, and so he said, of course, it's well, not of course, but his car had broke down in Delaware, right? And we're here in Northern Virginia, and so he was like, wow, he got a ride with some of the other coaches, and as they were driving, the one of the white coaches said to the other white coach that was driving, and my son was in the car with them. He said, "You drive like a nigga, right?" And so my son was like, "Whoa, you know?" And so he addressed him and said, "Don't ever say anything like that again, right?" And so he said, "Mom, I felt so uncomfortable because some of the other coaches in the car were snickering and laughing. No one else said anything to correct and say, 'Hey, man, what are we doing? Why were we, why did you say that? What or anything?'" So, of course, his car, because his car broke down, it was in the shop, and so he gets it today. But he said, "I have to get back in the car with them, right, tomorrow for the last game." And he said, "I really don't know what to do." So I was thinking about talking to the director and telling him. And I said, "Absolutely. You definitely need to let the director know what happened. And you need to address the young man." The young man is a little bit younger than my son, but the fact that he felt like he had the authority and and he had the boldness to say that in front of all the other white coaches in the car, it just really took my son aback, and he wasn't really sure what else he should do about that. But this was a young man that they have all coached together at different games, and he knows him. He said, "I thought he was cool, you know." But when that happened, it's like, you know, he just didn't know what to do. And so, and he said in his mind, the only thing that came to his mind is what happened, you know, to Noel Wells. And so, Nolan Wells. And so it, you know, this is so real of a situation that's happening. And now it's so impactful that, you know, there's a sense of fear and uncertainty about what to do when you're in total white spaces and something like that occurs. You're not sure what the next thing is going to occur and really how to deal with it. So I just wanted to share that situation that just happened to my son.
Thank you for sharing that, Norm. I'm gonna let you respond to that. You know, and Nishan, as a mom, I can only imagine how that made you and his dad feel. That's
Yeah,
horrible. Let me
it's
say
horrible.
that. That's horrible. And Norm, I'm going to, defer to you to just share whatever comes up for you regarding that. That's terrible.
Well, first of all, just thank you for sharing that story. I echo what Vicky said. It is absolutely horrible. Like, my heart dropped as you were telling the story. I'm grateful. It says a lot about how he was raised that he did report it. And having to get back in the car with them, what came up in my mind was, does he absolutely have to? So, I mean, I don't want to take the time to get into that, but it's maybe there are some alternatives there. And I think the main thing I want to say is that it's the whole when people show you who they are, quote, believe them. And so many times these kinds of comments get explained away, brushed off as jokes. It's just a word people use. I didn't mean anything by it. The fact even that others laughed, even though they didn't use that word, is also information. So hopefully your son will not just look at this as an isolated incident, but a turning point and ask some questions about his proximity and relationship with these individuals. And I'm not saying that he should never speak to them again or anything like that. But this becomes now information that he needs to fold into how he thinks about engaging with them. Because if it's inside of you and it comes out of you, then there's a reason that it came out. And I would hate for him to skip over it. And I'm sure that he won't. He gets to decide now what that relationship and that connection looks like. And just because we work together, doesn't mean that we have to, get down as friends necessarily, because some things have now changed.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, I love that you said it's information because it is. You know, there, I see your hand, Jules. I'm gonna come to you in like 10 seconds. There was another online post about a white mom who is raising a black son. She and her husband adopted a black son. They have four other children. And so she was aligning with us as black mothers, saying, "I know what it is. I know how you feel. I don't experience, haven't experienced directly the same level of racism, but I am keenly aware of how white people talk about black people when they're with other white people and no black people are around." And so she was talking about her vigilance of who's protecting my son when I'm not here. How is he being treated when me and his father are not around? And so it is information for all of us to continue our vigilance around racism, because regardless of what's being said, how we're gaslit or attempted to be gaslit, it's very real and it does exist. Jules, 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 come on off.
I am
Mute.
going to be quick. I'm so triggered. I appreciate you having this call today. And I talked to my sons, and I was just thinking, one of the biggest lessons that I kept explaining to him to know the clues when they were being gaslit was when they started saying, "Oh my gosh, you're one of the good ones," right?
and how explicit we have to be. And so, Norm, I just want you to address that for the record, because there are still some people of color, you know, our Black folks and all that talented tense stuff and all that kind of stuff is in their head, and they're feeding that to the children, and they're not understanding how that is really long term having a negative impact. So I just wanted to put that out there so
No,
that
that's
we
good.
as a people will address, get that stuff out of there so that they can understand what it means to be in these spaces. And so it's so much of an issue that I've been having to address with my sons and then them having that whole issue of saying, but well, they keep saying we're part of the talented 10th, and that whole dichotomy of conversation that goes on that we need to uplift even within our community because of the damage that it does long term when our children get in those spaces and are still trying to understand and understand who they are. And so I just wanted to put that out there and I'm leave it, but that's what I do. I just wanted
Thank
to
you.
make sure because I got three
Thank you. Go
boys.
ahead, Norm.
Okay.
Well, I'm just going to say that this is huge and deserves its own conversation. I've got a lot of feelings about the talented 10th and the underbelly of that archetype. As someone who is Greek and has been in, very privileged spaces that are mainly Black, and understanding the elements of toxicity around that when we aren't sufficiently anchored in our Blackness, period, irrespective of race or of class and socioeconomic status and our own imaginations about what it means to ascend, therefore leaving others who look just like us behind in some ways. So, Jules, thank you for naming this. And again, I would just say that this is its own conversation and deserves a lot of airtime, I think, because it's layered and complicated, but we need to talk about it more, and probably now more than ever, I would say.
Thank you, Norm. Thank you, Jules. We are out of time and not opposed to continuing the conversation, Norm. So would love to have you back to help us move in the direction of healing collectively and individually. And I just want to close with you sharing the importance of protecting and preserving our Black joy, right? We want to leave on somewhat of a high note today. As high as we can be. But talk about the importance of preserving our Black joy, protecting our Black joy and sense of adventure and pursuit and determination and perseverance. And like, this is not a time for us as people to shrink. It's a time for us to rise up, get loud, get bold, and be courageous. So I want to close with your comments, just about the importance of Black joy.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm gonna go back to those words I've been saying for the whole call for whatever reason. Go inside, and that I am finding personally that my Black joy is on the inside of me, because inside of me is where I tap into not only the fullness of who I am, but the fullness of what I'm a part of. And when I get quiet, in nature especially, the ancestors come to me. And I am reminded in many ways of the fact that I am on this earth, at least in part, to continue a legacy, an ancestral legacy that has many stops along the way and, much more road to travel. And so, even in thinking about my responsibility to carry on a familial legacy during my lifetime, it's a heavy responsibility, but it's also a source of joy, because what a privilege to be chosen to tell the stories that I've told about my family today. And that I'm not all rosy, but just the liberation in being able to talk about overcoming, is ancestral joy. And telling the stories that my kids roll their eyes at, but I promise you will tell their kids, is joy. And knowing that as a shallow breather, when I remember that my breath is shallow and I can like take a deeper breath, that is joy. And being on a call with folks where we can talk about really hard things and still talk about joy and not have to apologize for that, that is joy. So what I would say about preserving Black joy and stepping into Black joy is just be really intentional about accessing it. And if you think you have enough of it, know that you don't have enough. So there's nothing wrong, even in the darkest of times, in being proactive, intentional, and assertive in pursuing joy, because it is the thing that will allow us to stand, coalesce, overcome, be in solidarity. It's all anchored in joy and truth. And that lives on the inside of you. So tap into that unapologetically, is what I would say.
Beautiful. We're gonna come right out right there. Tap into it. Tap into your Black joy. Thank you for being here, everyone, on the Sunrise Project Sunday support call. We appreciate each of you. Come back to see us next Sunday, 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So the prayer today is to go in peace, go in power, go in love, and go in joy. Protect your Black joy. Have a powerful day, everyone. Thank you again, Dr. Norm Jones. Look forward to having you
Thank you.
back. You're always a tremendous blessing to us. Goodbye,
Thank you
everyone.
so
Have a
much.
good day.